Well, isn't this a goddamn surprise, pleasure, and privilege? This is not the Friday postgame show. It's not even Thursday. It's Tuesday. And the main show just finished with the two biggest hosts we have. I believe Cenk and Anna were on the show. I'm not even totally sure about that. And in full disclosure, with half an hour ago, maybe 45 minutes ago, I was asked if I could do the postgame show, like in the big leagues. And I said yes. And so here I am, following Cenk and Anna directly, live. There's probably actually an enormous audience for this, which I'm not used to. And that audience is not used to me. Maybe you've seen me with Malcolm and Steve on the Friday postgame show, but this is Tuesday. This is unprecedented. And so we're going to have to try to enjoy it, and you're going to have to enjoy a different style of postgame show. There's going to be no banter because I'm doing it by myself, which is really hard to do. But on the other hand, doing it with someone you don't want to do it with is also hard to do. So it's a little bit, you know, either way. So I didn't have anything prepared because I found out about this 45 minutes ago. So I quickly scrambled through the newspapers and I thought about some of the things that I've been exposed to in the past couple of days. And I thought I would just talk about those. There's no theme. There's no thread. I'm just going to go through a random list. And these might have absolutely nothing to do with each other. And they're all going to be superficial. So don't expect, you know, I didn't do research, I didn't do fact-checking, I didn't dig into it, I didn't get countervailing opinions. But it's the post-game show, so the standards are more to just relax and start the conversation. So I was reading an article about early civilization and how a lot of early civilizations in the Middle East were based on wheat. And maybe people learned about that in school, how that's one of the big staple crops in early human civilization. So people thought, well, there's something really efficient about wheat or nourishing or something special about it that makes it uniquely qualify as an agricultural crop, as a staple crop on which to build a civilization. But the author of this article in The New Yorker doesn't see it that way. He thinks the only big advantage of wheat was that it was easy for tax collectors to assess and count and tax because wheat is something that grows above ground, so a tax collector can come and see how much wheat is being grown. It can be stored for long periods of time, so a tax collector can come and confirm that so much wheat has been harvested. And it can be collected. If you're not going to collect money, you can actually take some wheat and take it with you as your tax. Other crops, like potatoes, grow underground, so it's harder for the tax collector to see them. Other crops can't be stored for as long a period of time. Wheat had all the characteristics that made it easy for tax collectors to count and assess and tax, and therefore they were able to build a civilization on top of it, because a civilization requires taxes. And that is how human society got so dependent on wheat as its staple crop. And that is true to this day. And that's very interesting. The truth is, I'm sure there is something uniquely nourishing and convenient about wheat. Probably all of the above ideas are the reason that wheat was the basis for early human civilization. But I had never thought of that. And when you're studying world history in whatever grade it is, 7th, 8th, 11th, you probably don't get that taxation angle on early wheat cultivation. So, but now you as TYT members do. So now we're going to go to the contemporary stories. There's a debate, a fake debate in the political circles, in the media, about regulations. Republicans think there are too many regulations, they're a burden, we have to reduce them, and supposedly Democrats support regulations, but that's not true, they want to reduce them as well. And this is presented as a real debate by the simplistic, superficial media. Except it's all fake, because then there are times when it's so obvious that we do need regulations in some areas. So I was listening to a radio report from a mayor of some small city in Florida right before Hurricane Irma hit. And he was talking about how he feels confident that his town is going to do well during the hurricane because since Hurricane Andrew 25 years ago, Florida has improved and made more strict its building codes and its regulations on how buildings should withstand hurricane force winds. And the reporter and the mayor And everybody involved in the story just took this as, oh yeah, that's great. That makes a lot of sense. That I'm very glad that that Florida took that direction, because now it's about to pay off as Hurricane Irma is about to slam into the state. In this little news story, where was the media balance? Where was the articles, the opposing point of view saying, no, regulations, there are too many of them. It's crippled Florida's growth. When it's real and obvious, all of a sudden that fake political debate melts away and no one's talking about it. When you actually see why it's so important to have regulations and building codes, because a hurricane is about to slam into your state, the debate goes away. The same thing kind of happens with gun control. There's supposedly a debate. Should we have gun control or should we not have gun control? And the right wing says we should have less gun control and no gun control. But where's the debate on whether guns should be allowed onto airplanes? No one's debating that. It's universally accepted 100% that passengers should not just carry guns onto an airplane. That's gun control. So gun control is 100% universally accepted. So where is the fake debate that you hear about on TV and in the political fights, you know, the CNN show, the crossfire kind of debates about gun control. It's bullshit. It's posturing. It's just political theater. In reality, of course, everyone wants some gun control, and most people want a lot of it. And final example on this theme is some article I read in the New York Times a few days ago. Memory is already fading on it because I don't do this professionally, and I didn't prepare it. But there, Monsanto is at it again. Most people, especially those who watch The Young Turks, know about how Roundup. It's the Monsanto pesticide. And the way Monsanto controls the entire agricultural business is they sell seeds, genetically modified seeds, that are susceptible to many pesticides, except they resist the pesticide that Monsanto sells. In the past, it's been Roundup. So if you buy these seeds, you're going to get plagues and your crops are going to deteriorate. If you spray them with other kinds of pesticides that Monsanto doesn't approve of, it's going to damage your crops. You have to get the Monsanto Roundup. Well, they're doing it again. There's another seed, and I forget all the names, specifically designed to withstand and to respond properly to one specific kind of pesticide that Monsanto sells. But the problem is all the other farmers who didn't buy the Monsanto seeds, if any of that Monsanto pesticide gets on their crops, it will damage them. It won't just kill the pesticides, it'll kill the crop. So it's blackmail, it's forcing all the farmers, the ones who want to and the ones who don't want to, giving them no choice. They have to buy the Monsanto seed, because once the Monsanto pesticide gets out in the environment, it's going to destroy everything except their own seeds. But there are two states who the agricultural department is fighting back against Monsanto and calling this an unethical business practice, etc. One of them is state of Arkansas. State of Arkansas, wait, that's a completely Republican-controlled state. What happened to letting businesses do what they want? What happened to no regulations? What happened to getting the government out of businesses? Well, no, because when it's real, when these businesses do actual harm, of course, Democrats, Republicans, left, right, they all want to protect their interests, whatever those interests may be. So there's no actual debate unless people are exploiting a debate and drumming up a fake debate to win elections or to score political points. But there's no actual debate on that. We need some kind of smart regulations and building codes, and we need some kind of control on out-of-control agricultural giants like Monsanto, who are corrupting the free market of agriculture by forcing farmers to use their products. So that's the regulations. Now we're going to be more on regulations. This is an article in Monday's New York Times, which you should clip out and put in some sort of book, wherever you keep your memorabilia, because it's going to be used in a documentary in like the year 2022, a documentary on the 2022 financial collapse. It's an article in Monday's New York Times about the Consumer Finance Protection Board, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, is going back to letting Wall Street regulate itself. So the Commodities Futures Trading Commission was built, created in the 70s, and they're supposed to regulate various forms of high-level financial trading, in particular, you know, risky financial instruments like derivatives. Now, under the Bill Clinton administration, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission was they were stopped from or blocked from regulating derivatives, and derivatives are what eventually blew up. It's part of, a large part of a contributing part of the 2008 financial crisis. And under Dodd-Frank and the years after the 2008 financial crisis, legislators, Congress tried to rein this in and put derivatives back under control of the Commodities Future Trading Commission. But the 2008 financial crisis is fading into memory, and Donald Trump became president. He appointed a new head of the CFTC, who believes that they should most companies want to abide by the law, most financial companies included, and that if you reduce the penalties and reduce the burden on these companies, they will voluntarily police themselves and minimize their risk and minimize the potential damage they can do to the global economy. Well, this is the same bullshit reasoning that Larry Summers and Alan Greenspan came up with in the late years of the Clinton administration and all through the George W. Bush administration, and it blew up in their faces. And even Alan Greenspan, Greenspan even had remorse about this and admitted in interviews that he was wrong to assume Wall Street could police itself. Well, it's happening all over again under the Trump-appointed head of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. It's happening all over again. So this article from the Monday, September 25th New York Times, front page of the Business Day, cut this out, put it in your memorabilia drawer because you're going to want to read it at the next financial crisis because this is going to blow up in our face again. I don't know. I would have guessed Cenk would have covered this article. I don't know. Maybe the guys in the control room know whether he did or not. I don't know. So that's a long series of articles. It turns out it did have a theme. It's all about regulations and our bullshit, fake political debate about them. Now I'm going to go to... I'm going to do a quick couple of little short ones because I know very little about them. There's another article in either today or yesterday's New York Times about how the Prime Minister of Japan, Abe, is calling for a snap election. Now, I know nothing about Japanese politics, so I'm not going to talk very much about this, but calling a snap election these days is a bad idea in general. I mean, Theresa May got screwed by it. Brexit, David Cameron thought that that was a great idea, and he got blindsided by that, and Brexit won. He didn't think it had any chance. And of course, Donald Trump, and there's many, many other elections where there have been a lot of surprises. France is another one. Japan is not like any of those countries. Every country has its unique political environment. But calling a snap election these days, it's not the Western world. I get it, but boy, that's risky. So that's in about a month. And let's see how that works out for Prime Minister Shinzo Abe if he gets what he wants out of this snap election. He thinks he's in a strong position, and by calling a snap election, he will consolidate his power. And maybe he will, but maybe given what's happened in the past few years, maybe he's in for a big surprise. If any TYT members know more about Japanese politics, and I know a lot do, some live in Japan, write in the comments below and I'll check it out and maybe we'll talk about it, follow up in a future postgame with me. The other article amuses me. It's from the New York Times again. I think it was last Sunday or maybe the Sunday before. It was in the travel section. And it talked about the devastation in the Caribbean from Hurricane Irma, which was a couple hurricanes ago. We're losing track here. And talked about some islands that were absolutely devastated and tourism is going to be hurt for a long time. And it talked about how Puerto Rico was relatively unscathed, unharmed, and is a good... You know, it's in fact a good place to visit. You can still go, and it's a staging ground for relief efforts to the other islands. Oops. That article appeared in the New York Times after Hurricane Maria, I think, wiped out Puerto Rico just as badly or worse than all those other islands. So obviously they wrote it after Irma, but before Maria, but they printed it after Maria, and it's a totally anachronistic at this point, an instantly out of date and absurd article in the travel section. And this is probably why a lot of people are just, they say, what the hell is this? Newspaper is an hour after it's published, a couple minutes after it's published, it's already outdated. And in that case, they're right. But like, if you read that article and say, yeah, I think I'm going to go to Puerto Rico on vacation, wrong. Do a little research online before you make that decision. So that's amusing to me. Another a very interesting article, and this is where something like the New York Times justifies it and wins its reputation. It was about the Mexican earthquake. In the popular imagination, we like to simplify things, so we like to know what the Richter, what the magnitude of the earthquake was on the Richter scale, 7.1, 8.2, in Chile there was a 9 point something, and that's all we know, and we assume that the bigger that number, the more powerful and deadly the earthquake is. We all know, anybody who studies this at all knows there's other factors. The biggest factor, especially in Mexico City, is what is the nature of the subsoil. In Mexico, it's been discussed a million times. It's built on a dry lake bed. It's a soft soil. Every time there's an earthquake, the soil sways massively, and that causes a lot of extra destruction in Mexico City. And you feel a lot more earthquakes there because of the nature of the soil. But it's not just that. There are a lot of factors. So, we're comparing the recent powerful earthquake that struck Mexico City to the one in 1985. The recent earthquake was, I believe, closer to Mexico City, and roughly, I forget the magnitude, but roughly as powerful as the one in 1985. But the 1985 earthquake killed 10,000 people, and this one killed 300 and destroyed about 50 buildings. Although Mexico City is messed up psychologically more so than infrastructure. And so initially there were articles, I'll say, Mexico woke up and after 1985 they imposed stricter building codes, and that's why this earthquake caused less damage. Wrong. Mexico did impose stricter building codes, but Mexico is a corrupt country, and there's no indication at all that those stricter building codes were followed or that buildings are under compliance to those stricter building codes in wide numbers. What happened, in fact, was a peculiar nature of this earthquake compared to the 1985 earthquake. It was just luck. The 1985 earthquake, first of all, the angle of the fault where the rocks that slipped was pointed in a way that was more directed toward Mexico City, whereas in this one, the angle of the fault was slightly off. In 1985, it was the epicenter of the earthquake was a long way away, so a lot of the high-frequency waves, seismic waves, died out by the time they got to Mexico City. But the low-frequency waves made it to Mexico City, and the low-frequency waves shook the ground in a way that caused structural failure to taller, higher buildings, 8 to 16-story buildings. So a lot of 8 to 16-story buildings in Mexico City collapsed in 1985, killing a lot more people, 10,000 or more. This earthquake a few weeks ago was a lot closer to Mexico City. The high-frequency seismic waves did not dissipate because it was so close, and those frequencies affect mostly shorter buildings. So a lot of the buildings that collapsed last week or 2 weeks ago were shorter, obviously, less tall, obviously causing fewer deaths. So, I mean, that's a good thing, but it's not necessarily the building codes. In fact, that famous school that collapsed a couple weeks ago in the earthquake theoretically was inspected 1 week before the earthquake. It had a structural inspection, and it passed. It was deemed earthquake ready, and that's obviously not true. I've learned more about that school. I don't have all the facts straight, but I believe it's two separate buildings. One a little older, one a little newer that was built in violation of land use rules. It was built without a permit, fraudulently, through corruption. And that's the half of the school that collapsed in this earthquake, of course, because there's a reason that the land use did not permit building on that plot of land. So it wasn't going to be safe. So that's an indication that these strict building codes were not followed because of corruption. So that is Mexico City. Going strong here in this legendary Dave Kohler solo post-game. I hope the audience is still with me. The New York Times, I believe today, maybe on Monday, ran an article about a University of Wisconsin survey of people who did not vote in the 2016 election. Now, Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin by 22,000 votes to Donald Trump. The headline coming out of this survey is that around 17,000 or maybe more voters did not vote because of recently imposed voting restrictions by the Republican state governors, state government that came into power at the legislative level in 2011. So the Republicans come in, they've done this all over, they pass laws to restrict voting, and it works, and it's sickening. So they Republicans passed laws in Wisconsin that required you to have all sorts ID, voter ID laws, because they are claiming that there's this rampant voter fraud, but all studies show that that's almost negligible. The much bigger damage is caused by people who now can't vote. So usually there rarely are studies of non-voters. Usually they are studied using statistical methods. But this time the University of Wisconsin actually went to the non-voters and did a survey of them. Now, only about 6% of the people they talked to didn't vote because they didn't have the ID, but all the rest didn't even bother to go to vote because they thought they were not going to pass the strict voter ID requirements. And in fact, 8 of 10 of these voted in the last election, so they're not chronic non-voters. These are people who wanted to vote, but because of the laws, laws that restrict the franchise in Wisconsin, many of them, the disenfranchisement laws, basically, many of them didn't vote. And then, of course, these are directed, these have a higher impact in minority districts and low-income areas. And this wasn't just Wisconsin. This happened in North Carolina and Michigan, many states, Ohio. It's been happening since 2000. Florida, of course, it's the most egregious case. And not nearly enough attention is paid to voting restrictions. Some is paid on the Young Turks, but Jen can talk about it a lot more because we talk about these elections, oh, and Hillary screwed up because Donald Trump won. Sure, that's true, but who knows what the biggest factor is, but a huge factor is that so many tens of thousands of people couldn't or didn't vote at all because of laws passed to keep them from voting, even though they're perfectly legitimate, valid, eligible voters. So that's a little tidbit on voting restrictions in Wisconsin and how this is more evidence that these kind of laws tipped the election. So my last topic is more open-ended. I've been watching the Ken Burns Vietnam War documentary. If Bart's been watching it too, then I hope you have a mic and you can chime in. So I think it might already be done. I'm watching it on replay. It's multi-parts. I've watched three parts. The first covers 100 years of Vietnamese history from French colonial times to the Kennedy administration. The second covers a couple years of the Kennedy administration. The third covers the early Johnson period. Now, everyone knows, anyone who's had any kind of education knows about the Vietnam War and what a horrific, gross, destructive, catastrophic mistake it was, not just for the United States, but mostly for the Vietnamese people. And then people who are educated in history or just remember it saw it repeating itself in the Iraq War in 2000. I keep forgetting all the years, 2003, whenever George W. Bush invaded Iraq. The Iraq case was actually in some ways more egregious because it was blatantly obvious unjustified war. No evidence at all for it. No indication that it was a good idea. At least in the Vietnam era, if you believe that communism was a threat, I get it why so many people thought, well, we got to stop them somewhere. So they chose Vietnam to stop them. But it's a template, and it's far worse. You know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers went, 60, 50, 60,000 died. Many, many, many times more that Vietnamese civilians and Vietnamese people died. All the numbers are much worse than Iraq, much more damaging. The government lied in Iraq for a couple of years. The government lied in the Vietnam War for 10, 15 straight years. So on a scale, it's much worse. It's just not quite as clean because there's that's in the context of the time. I mean, you see President Lyndon Johnson on tape and John F. Kennedy on tape saying to their aides, this is a bad idea. Once we go in, we can't get out. But I have to go in. And they're torn. They're legitimately torn. You could think Johnson is an absolute asshole and son of a bitch. And he is for that Vietnam War. But it seems sincere that he really didn't want to get into it. He felt, as president, trapped. As a human being, he was not trapped. At some point, you know, the Vietnam War didn't just happen overnight. We got to it step by step by step over a decade, and then it lasted a decade more. At some point during that process, it was okay for Johnson or for Kennedy or for someone to say, okay, that is enough. But they never did. They never did right up until the end. I have more to say about this. I want to hear Bart to chime in, and maybe you'll redirect me where I want to go with this.
Well, basically for me, since I've been watching that documentary, it's just the whole entire thing is the lessons of history that we do not learn. Because, you know, today, it's the same thing today as it was back then. Because back then it was like fighting against communism. It's just today, it's just a different ism.
Yeah.
Terrorism. That's basically it. And for me, it's like the very first episode is very, very important because it discussed the history of the French being involved in the Vietnam War, which started over 100 years ago in the 1850s. And I had somewhat of a small knowledge of that because when I was watching the movie Apocalypse Now, they inserted a scene back into the movie where they went up and met at a French plantation and they were having a dinner there. And in that scene, it was discussing about how the Americans are not learning the lessons of history of the French involvement of Vietnam. And that just, and the documentary now is just like giving me more and more and more, you know, of sure. That background. It's amazing.
It's a great documentary. It's Ken Burns. He's famous for that Civil War documentary, which was also amazing. But I'm getting a little tired of him, but this is a great documentary. That learning the lessons of history, it's not like, oh, you should learn what the what the Prussians did in 1725. The French got their asses kicked in 1954. The Americans took over immediately. It's not lessons from the past. It's lessons from their own memories of just a few days, weeks, months, years ago. So it really is the folly of our leadership. Now, I also, of course, I had a superficial knowledge of the Vietnam War. I know what's going on there. But to tell you the truth, I never really knew what the war was about on a day-to-day basis, what we were actually doing. Like, I get World War II, the American involvement. You invade France, you land on France, and then you got to advance all the way to Berlin. And there's battles along the way with European names that I can read, pronounce, remember, and recognize. I hear about battles in Vietnam. Unfortunately, it's a Vietnamese language. The cities have strange names. It's hard to remember, getting real. But I also didn't understand, what battles? Like, why was there a battle? And then the documentary explains it. So the U.S., and this is how you get sucked in, the U.S. wants to support the South Vietnamese government against the communist North. We want to do that. We don't want to send in ground troops. We want to use air power because we don't kill our own guys. Helicopters at first, small, little things. So we set up air base. You can't just set up an air base. The Viet Cong are going to lob mortars into it and fuck you up. So you got to expand the perimeter. How do you do that? You send soldiers out. And that's where you get your battles. So you say, okay, we got to go in this direction. And then they ambush you and you have to fight. And you say, okay, well, we need to expand the perimeter. So we got to get a whole bunch of helicopters and land over here. I remember clearly the episode on landing zone X-ray. So the U.S. sent, not a lot, a couple hundred, 500 men or something. We got to go and land on this area. It's strategically located, and from there we can control the surroundings so that we can operate in our zone of South Vietnam. So the U.S. sent its, I'm forgetting the numbers, it's 500 or so men there. Bart can correct me if he remembers something else. And the Vietnamese secretly and with brilliant guerrilla tactics attacked the U.S. with, the U.S. thought that there were like 1,500 men in the jungle. It turns out there were 4,000. They swarmed the U.S. And the only reason the Americans saved themselves on that landing zone is because they called in every air resource they had in South Vietnam, and they bombed the surrounding area flat into a moonscape. And many hundreds of Vietnamese were killed in that battle. I think dozens of Americans. I mean, the ratio was 10 to 1, and that's the famous ratio that all the generals talked to the politicians about and to the public. You know, yeah, some of our guys died, but 10 times as many of their guys died. But we don't, that's awful, and but none of them should be dying. And anyway, a couple days after the landing zone X-ray debacle, the U.S. did get its ass kicked totally at a different landing zone just a few miles away. And this was seen by the North Vietnamese as a giant morale-boosting victory. I also found it strange. The Vietnam War is a huge international geopolitical event that rocked the whole country and the world. But these battles were fought by 400 American soldiers against 4,000 Vietnamese. These were not World War II or even Civil War battles with thousands of guys going against thousands of guys on the other side. These were all tiny little battles, all seeming so pointless when it's all over. And the government, you know, the liberals talk about how the government lies. It's not figurative, or it's not a manner of speech. They lie. They directly lie. They lie about what the American objectives are in Vietnam, about what the American military is doing in Vietnam. And of course they lied about the Iraq War. We debate on what is a lie, like did Colin Powell lie about weapons of mass destruction, or did he truly himself believe the evidence? Yeah, you can debate that. But some of these things are lies. Lyndon Johnson just lied, and his administration lied about what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam and about how it was going. Anybody who was there and thought about it objectively saw that the U.S. was getting its ass kicked by the guerrilla warfare, and they just lied about it and hid that from the American people. Johnson sent Marines, soldiers, bombing missions, and they just lied about all of it until they couldn't anymore and slowly revealed it. So, I don't know, I'm less than halfway through. It's a great documentary. I'm glad I'm learning about the Vietnam War. There's so much more. I could do a whole post-game on that. And as I get into more chapters, so I tend not to want to do this because I'm not a natural performer. So I say, all right, here I am doing a post-game show, and I'm going to talk about the Vietnam War documentary from Ken Burns. Well, why? Why don't you just go watch it yourself? Well, you don't need me to tell you about it for. Well, I guess people don't have 25 hours or whatever the hell it is to watch the whole thing. So I'm trying to tell you some of the highlights. And I've enjoyed this, so I'm going to do more of it. It hurts to talk about the Vietnam War because it was such a catastrophe. But I'll gather some thoughts and talk more about Ken Burns' documentary next time I have the privilege of doing a post-game show for the TYT members. So for now, thank you to all the TYT members. I'm glad that I was able to do this with you. A-Team, live, midweek post-game show. It's great. I'm not going to be able to do this Friday's post-game show. So give Malcolm all the support you can as he drums up some people to do it with. And I assume Cenk and Anna will be back with you for the Wednesday postgame show. But for now, thank you for watching, for being members. And if you're watching live, good night.